Welcome to the 59th episode of the Jewish Drinking Show. I'm your host, Rabbi Drew Kaplan. I'm very excited to welcome back, return guest, really, Professor Vadim Putsu.
Thank you, Drew.
My pleasure. For those less familiar with him, Dr. Putsu here is an associate professor at Missouri State University, whose doctoral dissertation entitled Bottled Poetry, Quencher of Hopes, Wine as a Symbol and as an Instrument in Sephardim Kabbalah and Beyond is, as you can imagine, about wine and Kabbalah. He also, and this is really right now fascinating, is he is presently teaching a course at Missouri State University, Go Bears, called Intoxicating Religion. So that is about beer and wine in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. So that is going on right now, and I'm sure all of us would like to be there taking that. It's online, right?
It's in person with the possibility of zooming in for other people. Well, because we're still in a pandemic semester, and so yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, that sounds really neat. And hopefully, in the future, your dissertation will become a book. So
that's a plan. That's the plan for my sabbatical.
Yes. Awesome. All right. And we are shooting this in the evening, so I do have some wine. Dr. Putsu is presently in his office on a very dry campus. So that's just where we're at. All right. So speaking of drinking and not drinking, we are talking about drinking on Purim, but in Kabbalah. And we're focusing really specifically on one thinker, right? Rabbi Chaim Vital.
Right. Right. So right. We're talking about Lurianic Kabbalah and specifically the version, which is perhaps the most, you know, well-known version of Lurianic Kabbalah that was recorded and presented by one of Luria's main disciples, Chaim Vital, in the late 16th century.
Yeah. Late 16th century. So I know you had spoken to me before about, he's not a big fan of drinking, right? Or he is, or isn't?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends.
In general, having nothing to do with the Purim context.
Right. Yeah. In general, it depends. So Vital has a number of things to say about water and how drinking water may be dangerous because it can get you, well, sick because probably of, you know, bacteria and other things present, especially in wells where, you know, people would get the water from back in the days. And the idea that water was an unsafe drink as opposed to wine, which was a much safer drink, is one that we see throughout antiquity and the Middle Ages and really all the way into the 18th or maybe even the 19th century, where water became safe because of developments in like public health and things like those.
And geographically, where was he living?
So Chaim Vital was living in Tzfat, so in Northern Galilee, the city of this, you know, Kabbalistic Renaissance in the mid 16th century, mainly thanks to the gathering of a number of especially Sephardi Jews, first, even second, third generation of Spanish and Portuguese exiles, and then who were joined by some Ashkenazi Jews and some Italian Jews. Chaim Vital was Chaim Vital Calabrese. He was coming from southern Italy, in fact.
Oh, wow.
So they all had that opportunity to, you know, go back after centuries to return to the land of Israel and to be able to live out their Judaism pretty much freely there after hundreds and hundreds of years. And so, you know, that gathering and concentration of Jews who were able to return to living their traditions freely, especially after having to live as Christians, as Maranos, was extremely important and had a lot of impact into things that they did and the things that they thought.
All right. So you mentioned he writes a lot about water. So what does he write about wine?
So about wine, Vital seems to have a couple of different things to say. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, he seems to be saying that there's a sort of a secular space, a sort of a non-ritual use for wine, for example, in medicine. in healing practices, even in magical practices. Mm-hmm. Vital even writes about growing vineyards and tending to vines in mm-hmm. one of his patchwork works, collections of different opinions and different things. Doesn't seem to put a lot of weight on, for example, the issue of stam ye inam, or of wine that is non-kosher, essentially, because it was not made under Jewish supervision and so on and so forth. So that doesn't seem, that kind of liquid doesn't seem to be especially interesting to him. He's not very concerned about it.
Hmm.
What Vital seems to be a little more concerned about,
yeah,
is the use of wine in for halachic purposes, essentially for, and more specifically for ritual purposes, as part of, which is to say, all of those mitzvot, all of those commandments that require the use of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of those, Vital, like a lot of Kabbalists before him, tends to attribute a symbolic value to wine. He views wine as a sort of a material, earthly, if you will, embodiment, representation of one of the ten sfirot, one of the aspects of the divine manifestation in the universe.
So for those, before I just refer everybody to the Introduction to Wine in Kabbalah episode that we did previously, can you just do a quick breakdown of this, of these 10 sfirot?
Yeah, we don't even need to go into the whole kind of list of 10.
Sure.
What's important here to understand, I believe, is that according to one of the, perhaps one of the main tenets, perhaps the most distinctive tenet of Kabbalah, is the idea that the entire universe was created by and is maintained by a retinue, a structure of 10 divine emanations, which, depending on the Kabbalist, can be seen as vessels of divine energy,
mm-hmm.
or as tools that God uses somehow to manage creation. Those 10 aspects of the divine are present at every level of reality. Hmm. They are, in a sense, within each and every one of us. They are manifested in history. They have counterparts in nature. Again, they are arranged in a structure. And so the key, because this is a structure of interconnected divine hypostasis, the key is that that structure need to be balanced. It need to be in a state of harmony. There has to be a sort of flow from one vessel to another. There are channels that unite and make that structure, almost like pipes that allow for divine energy to flow properly. Liquid metaphors abound: water, oil, wine. However, for most Kabbalists, back to the Middle Ages, the present state of the universe is one where that balance, that perfect harmony and flow is not a reality. And it needs to be, there's some sort of imbalance, there's some sort of rupture. And because of that, that needs to be remedied. And the way to remedy that is through human action, more specifically to the performance of the mitzvot.
Hmm.
Because of that, then every commandment, if performed correctly, is an opportunity to contribute to that unification, to that reharmonization of the divine structure that functions as a ontological substratum of the entire universe. So to the extent that wine then may serve as a material, semi-natural representation of those forces, at least in Vital's view, it symbolizes a particular or a certain side of those forces. I mentioned that this is a structure, and as a structure, it has a sort of a, you know, an upper part and a lower part. It also has a left side and a right side and a center. And all of that needs to be in harmony. The key, more often than not, is to rebalance the left side and the right side. As you can easily imagine, the left side is the sinister side, and so is considered to be, is associated with the quality of divine judgment. So the idea of God, who is more the guy who disciplines and punishes, or who constrains and restricts, as opposed to the right side as the side of mercy, of love. The general idea is that those two need to be balanced. We need both, right? This is not just, it's not all about love. That doesn't work. In the case of Vital, his general assessment of the universe is that there is too much judgment, that the divine quality of judgment is present in excess in the world that he's living. Because of that, it needs to be, and this actually goes back to the Zohar, the ultimate meaning, the ultimate significance, or the ultimate intent of all the mitzvot is, to use a Zoharic expression, is to sweeten the judgment. Okay, the Zohar uses a fascinating Aramaic expression. The Zohar is a medieval text. The expression is in Aramaic, of course, being in the Zohar, and it's to it basen dinin, so literally to sweeten judgments. The interesting thing is that to those who study the language of the Zohar, it became quite clear that since it's not a medieval manufactured Aramaic, it's not the Aramaic of the Talmud, although it tries to present itself as such. The Aramaic verb itbasem was introduced as a translation of a Spanish term, endulzar, to sweeten. Mm. Wine in and of itself tended to be very acidic, very astringent.
Mm.
So not very good. And if you go to like a cheap restaurant in Spain today, like a family restaurant, oftentimes wine is served alongside a bottle of like Sprite or some sort of carbonated sweet soda.
Wow.
Because the red wine that you start with is so sour that you mix it.
Sour? Like actually sour? Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, good Spanish wine these days is nothing like that, but like super cheap stuff that is served is like that.
Hmm.
And so there may be a connection between that expression of saying, sweetening the judgment, as of adding something sweet to something that represents judgment, that has to do very much with wine. And in Chaim Vital's understanding of each and every mitzvah that includes wine drinking, wine symbolizes the judgment and the ritual is intended to sweeten that judgment. So wine is actually a sort of almost like a negative. It's like a negative element that the ritual is supposed to, in a sense, neutralize.
Yeah.
Or counterbalance.
Yeah.
And how do you counterbalance? Well, you do it through blessings.
Mm-hmm.
You do it through kavana, which is through special intention, which means focusing on certain, aspects of the divine, focusing on certain divine names that are supposed to be powerful and to act, against or on that wine. So wine represents a judgment that needs to be sweetened. That's what Vital has to say about the role of wine in Jewish ritual.
I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. This is the first of three in a lead up in a series up to Purim this year. And stay tuned for a sneak peek into next week's episode.
So you had mentioned earlier that is wine reflected in one of the sefirot?
Yes. So wine is typically typically used as, again, an earthly symbol for the divine sefirah of judgment. It's called Din or Gvura.
Okay.
Now in Lurianni Kabbalah, this complicates things a little, because Lurianni Kabbalah focuses less on sefirot, on the 10 sefirot, and more on certain configurations that the sefirot take after the second attempt at creation. I don't want to go too much into that. But however you put it, it is still associated with all those left sinister side of divine power mm-hmm. that is considered to be, so to speak, again, the harsh part of God's management of the universe.
Does Rabbi Vital explain why he matched those two up? Why?
Well, it's I mean, he's not the first at all, because the first association of wine with the kind of the sphira or sefirot that are representative of divine judgment is in Sefer HaBa'ir in the 12th century.
So it's
a very old connection. It's a very old connection. He just kind of picks it up.
Gotcha.
He's part of a long line in that sense. So mm-hmm. It's nothing uncommon or especially striking.
Yeah. Okay. So laying the groundwork for with wine and then doing the ritual performance with the wine to counterbalance it, to sweeten the deal, so to speak. So that brings us to Purim, drinking on Purim. So Rabbi Vital, if one of the actions, at least as stated in the Talmud and by Rava, as well as being eventually codified in the Shulchan Aruch as a necessity on Purim to get drunk, to get drunk until one doesn't know how wicked Haman is and blessed Mordechai is. I haven't had that much wine. I know the difference for this. So
for the moment,
how does he deal with it? How does he deal with it? Because he's essentially using the wine to, I mean, it's not like to do anything else. It's not for Kiddush. It's not for Avdala. It's really just for your own self, right? So how does he deal with that?
Yeah, so he has a couple of things to say, mm-hmm. and this is repeated in Pri Etz Chaim, where he talks specifically about Purim, mm-hmm. and in some of his other writings. I want to quote first a first passage, you can actually find, I mean, the Hebrew is easy to find these days because Pri Etz Chaim can be found on Sepharia.
Mm-hmm.
You can easily track the Hebrew, here's, I'm offering my translation here. So this is from Pri Etz Chaim, Sharosh Chodesh Chanukah VePurim in chapter 6. And here's what he says. Here's what our rabbis of blessed memory said about a man must get drunk on Purim to the point that he cannot tell between cursed be Haman and blessed be Mordechai. The meaning is that it is known that there are sparks of holiness in every husk that sustain them. And if they, that is the sparks, leave the husk, no sustenance remains for it, and the husk is completely annihilated at once.
And what are these husks? In Luria, oh,
this
and
is a very bizarre introduction to the problem, where you're like, okay, I thought I was thinking about getting drunk, and now you're talking about sparks and husks and annihilation of one. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. All right, so this goes back to a general fundamental idea in Lurianic Kabbalah, which is to say the idea of what is called in Hebrew Shvirat Akelim, the rupture of the vessels, and the idea that the world that we live in is the result of a cosmic drama, of I mean, it's not clear if it's an accident or if it was like planned for some sort of purpose. Scholars are kind of divided on this, but anyway. But the idea is that our world is the result of the breaking of the original sephirotic structures, right? We said that sephirot were vessels which contain divine energy. At the beginning of everything, the first time that divine energy was poured into these vessels in order to create the universe, the vessels could not contain divine energy. They were not strong enough to do that, and so they broke. And in a sense, just like, when you have a bottle of, let's say, of oil, right, and that bottle of oil explodes, in the little shards, the little pieces of glass that you have, even if all the oil is gone, even if you clean up all the oil, there's still going to be some sort of drop of oil stuck to that piece of glass. So that's our word. Our word is essentially a word made of broken vessels, which are called klipot, sparks. Mm-hmm. Husks made essentially of judgment, divine judgments. Mm-hmm. But in each and every one of them lies a drop of divine energy, which is called a spark, nitzutz. Our world is only sustained by the fact that everything that we see, despite being, in a sense, negative, a broken vessel, a broken piece of divine judgment, it contains that spark that vivifies it. As the text says here, those sparks of holiness are there, are in every husk to sustain them. And once we separate those, once we, they're in a sense, they are trapped. But if we are able, with our own actions, with our own behavior, with our own performance of the commandments, essentially, we can free those sparks of holiness from the prison of obscure judgment, so to speak, of husks that contain them, then those negative vessels, coverings, will just fall apart. So in a sense, that puts a very lofty goal, if you will, a very heightened significance on the performance of everyone's commandments, which is basically to free divine sparks from the bondage that they're in. But the ultimate result of it is the annihilation of the world that we live in, is the return of all divine energy to its source, and therefore the ultimate end of our world.
Which is a bad thing, right?
Well, considering that our world is essentially bad.
Well, then we wouldn't have anywhere to live.
But we would have fulfilled our mission.
Oh, okay.
Right? It's the act of tikkun, of repairing the word, ends with the word ending.
Wow.
According to Liani Kaba. So the interesting thing right there is that sort of introductory line is connected to a much longer text, which talks about, you know, what happens when we get intoxicated on Purim. Right? So the idea, remember, the idea then is that even in the most obscure, problematic, evil, if you want, piece of reality, lies therein underneath and sustains and is sustained by a divine spark of holiness, right? And so how do we get to that? So the text goes on and says, repeats the quotation from Megillah 7b in the Talmud. And it says the following: the meaning, the kavanah, is that always within the husk there is a spark of holiness that shines inside it and vitalizes it. And therefore, one must say, blessed be Haman, to draw light to this spark. And therefore, one must say this without other intention that he's drunk and lost his mind. Since, shall there be strength and courage in the intention, the kavanah, it will also shine toward the husk with strength and courage. So the idea is that by blessing something that is evil, Haman, you are sweetening the judgment. You are drawing the divine light to that lowermost piece of evil manifestation. And by doing that, you are able, eventually, as we shall see, to basically break away, allow that divine sparks that's hidden there to become strong enough to break away from that sort of prison that it's trapped into. But you have to be very careful in doing it. You can only do it if you're out of your mind. Because if you're doing it in your right mind, so to speak, you're basically strengthening something that is evil and it shouldn't be strengthened. Right, you're sacralizing, you're bringing divine force to something that really shouldn't have it. So you're engaging in something that is potentially sinful, and so you don't want to strengthen that.
You mean by getting drunk?
Yes.
Okay.
Right, and by, you know, by blessing Haman.
Oh, by blessing Haman. Okay.
Right, but if you do it having in mind, I guess, that you're drunk, that you're really out of your mind, that you're doing the opposite of what should be doing in some sense, then it's fine. Right? And he goes on and says, it seems in my humble opinion that when we draw the light of the brain of the Bina in Rachel, this is the idea that, again, this is the sephirotic structure, that the upper part of the Sephirotic structure, Bina is considered to be one of the higher divine manifestations. And if its energy can be drawn down mm-hmm. to lower divine manifestations, then that's exactly what has happened. And we do it by means of drinking wine in great abundance. There is a great illumination. Hmm. As there is in it the force to illuminate also this spark, which is within the husk. It is to say, right, the divine spark that sustains a less than perfect word that is full of judgment, that is full of, evil, if you want to put it that way. Those divine spark that sustains that is so covered in husks, if you will, that it barely sparks. But if you draw through your drinking on Purim, a lot of wine, more divine energy into it, then you basically make it explode.
Oh, wow.
And it says, well, we have the force to illuminate also the sparks that is within the husk. And in drinking, one might direct his intention to a couple of divine names. This is part of, the kind of the specific Lurianic ritual. Mm. And one must direct the intention to draw to it the brains of Chochmah through eating and brains of Bina through drinking, etc., etc. I think there's a very interesting dynamic here, right? Because Purim is one day when you're doing things, you're commanded to do things that are nobly prohibited, essentially.
I don't know.
Of getting drunk, definitely.
Getting drunk is definitely outside of sort of maybe a more normative rabbinic understanding of the world. That's not necessarily a sinful thing. It's certainly not typical. I think it's certainly atypical. I think it really stands out as certainly anomalous as far as having a mitzvah aspect to, and having, you know, it's funny for me hearing him talking about like wine is sort of like not necessarily a necessary evil, but like an uncomfortable requirement as a tool. And here it's almost like you can feel him like working through the process of like him having to advocate getting not only drinking, but drinking and accept like getting drunk, and he's having to work out how it could be it's actually a good thing, right?
Right.
And so it's certainly like there's like this discomfort that he has to work through and manage to make it work, right?
And make sense. But I think it works because it's Purim,
right? But to see him doing the intellectual gymnastics to make it work and make it happen is certainly something that it's not obvious.
Yeah. But, you know, I think one of the interesting things about this text, though, is that it kind of may lead into some of the ideas that some scholars have seen as the kind of the transition between Lurianic Kabbalah and Sabbateanism, where you have, in order to completely fulfill all of the mitzvot, in order to accomplish the entirety of the tikkun, in order to free all of the sparks of holiness from the trap that is our word, at some point, someone has to break the rules, in a sense, has to have the spiritual stature to bring that divine light into the deepest recess of potential, at least sinfulness, to give it the last kick. And I think this is where this is going.
Oh, wow.
In many ways. So Purim is this day that's unique. It's marked by an amount of blessing that it can be extended even to domain where divine effluence would normally never arrive. And I think there's really here, this is one of those texts where you have an inversion of regular values, where for that one day only you bless the word of evil. It's a sort of command and transgression that basically reconfirms and reinforces the ordinary values of separation between good and evil or divine and material. And this is the consequence of intoxication, right? The fact that you can draw down the divine light into the realm of husk for the sake of liberating the spark that even the villain possesses is through the intoxication. Because this is otherwise a sinful act of engaging the domain of evil is performed is an otherwise sinful state of consciousness. I mean, intoxication is a sinful state of consciousness by and large.
Is that for Rabbi Vital?
Right, yes.
So he has to make a special exception for Purim.
Right, in a sense, so this is an otherwise antinomian practice that becomes justified within a context where all the values and rules are reversed. Mm-hmm. There's this kind of focus that you can have, but only if you're drunk.
Mm.
impaired state of the practitioner here impacts his spiritual intention. On one hand, while drinking, he's required to maintain a very strong focus on illuminating and vivifying the sparks to liberate them from the trapping among the klipot, without, however, bringing light also to the husks themselves. On the other hand, since you know his drunkenness would render his kavana, his intention, imperfect, then it is recommended the performer directs his intention to the husk so that divine light can be drawn even there. Again, as I said, only someone who is out of his mind would bless evil. But in the day when this action is halachically required, it brings about an exceptional redemptive effect. And again, I think this is unique because normally that never happens. In any other text of Vital that I was able to read, you never have that. Wow. And in that sense, it confirms, right? The idea that this is the exception that confirms the rule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I hope you've been enjoying this episode so far. Here is a sneak peek featuring Professor Joshua Joel Spolstra in next week's episode on drinking events in the Book of Esther.
Of the 20 appearances this term makes in this book, only I think 4 of them are in the construct form of Mishte Yain, right?
Yeah.
Right. So only 4 of them, and really sort of more in the middle of the book.
Yes.
Which is a teaser.
I hope you enjoyed that sneak peek into next week's episode featuring Professor Spolstra. And now back into our show.
This changes. This is different from, you know, then Hasidic masters later. Because one of the important things here to understand is that the result of this is that the husk break apart and collapse. So if this is a sort of a game between good and evil,
yeah,
right, the idea is that an excess of good destroys evil, and so that redemption is a separation between good and evil, and that evil exists only because it's sustained by good.
Oh, okay.
And once you separate the two, then evil collapses. Whereas if you take certain Hasidic masters, such as like Nachman of Breslov, right? Classically for Hasidism, one says that the idea is that you redeem evil. You do not redeem the sparks from evil, but you redeem them alongside evil, right? And so there's a similar text in Nachman of Breslov, for example, that says that there's that kind of nuance. So it's interesting to see that there.
It's really interesting to hear that contrast. Hear the broader, I don't know, that context of where wine fits in within his worldview, and then having to justify not only drinking, but getting drunk on Purim, I think for him is really... He has to do the gymnastics. He has to do the mental gymnastics to make it work.
Right. Yeah.
And no. Also to advocate for the performance of it.
Yeah. No. It's interesting because yes, I think he has to do the mental gymnastics, but he's not alone. And you have to do the mental gymnastics, especially I think if you have this kind of ascetic standpoint, this kind of idea that the world after all is evil, especially that material stuff is ultimately evil, and anything that brings kind of that kind of feeds your material desires, your carnal desires, is evil.
Oh wow.
Right, it's bad. And that's true of Vital, it's true of Caro, but for example, it's not true of Cordovero or, you know, other Kabbalists in spot like Al-Kabetz. And of course, you know, we're talking about wine, but we could be talking about sex and would be essentially the same.
Sounds like they were unhappy with their material surroundings.
Well, you know, some were not, for sure.
Yeah.
And again, you know, that makes perfect sense. I mean, in a place like Sfat, I think in the 16th century, you could have both, right? Because some saw the opportunities that being able to go back to Israel and to, you know, live as Jews again after centuries was a great opportunity. And so, you know, people like Cordovero, I think, you know, the way they treat the same text, the way they read the same text, they see the opportunities. They're like, oh, now we can do this and we have so many possibilities. And other people like Caro, who was himself an exile from Spain, right?
Yeah.
Caro was still born in Spain. And even somebody like Vital, for whatever reasons, they were more, in my reading, they were more eager to see the problems, the issues, the fact that they were still living, you know, I don't know, amidst Muslims, for example, that they were carrying the weight of, you know, the sins of the generations before them, or having lived as non-Jews for some time, or, you know, maybe their parents or grandparents having done that. Vital has all sorts of, because he's also written, actually both Cairo and Vital wrote some sort of spiritual autobiographies, in which you can see that they were struggling with a lot of kind of stuff themselves. Vital was scolded by Luria because he had engaged in like alchemy and, you know, magic and other stuff that was considered to be kind of worthless by Luria. Cairo, of course, you know, Cairo wished to be burnt at stake. Come on. I mean, it doesn't get any worse than that.
Wow.
And so I think in their case, you know, they were seeing more of kind of the negative side. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were looking at the world with different eyes, I think. And because of that, I think it was all about anything that would kind of feed into their more kind of worldly, I guess, instincts.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, they saw in a negative light.
Thank you, Dr. Putsu. This is really insightful and very interesting. Thank you for sharing with us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And L'chaim.
L'chaim to you.